You're listening to CKMS 102.7 FM in Wattle, Ontario, radiowattle.ca on the web. This program is a part of the Local Journalism Initiative and is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Government of Canada, and the CKMS Newsroom. You can access the recordings of this show on radiowattle.ca/news or on the National Local Journalism Initiative website. I'm your host, Ivan Angelovsky.
Questions are still swirling tonight about what exactly happened the moments before a young black woman fell to her death from her High Park apartment yesterday.
There were allegations in the wake of Ms. Wachinski-Paquette's death that she was pushed off the balcony by the police. The evidence establishes that this did not occur.
As the outline today, the SIU has cleared our officers of wrongdoing and determined that they acted appropriately and within the law.
We're totally disgusted with the outcome. We know that they're hiding things and we're not okay with it, and we don't believe them, and that's our true beliefs, and they're saving their We're not okay with the way that the system works. We're not okay with it. Nobody is. And I don't know why you guys can't see it that way, but we see it that way. And it's unjust. And it seems like everybody's not getting justice for what they deserve. You know, what happened to my sister shouldn't have happened to her, but it did. So people need to be held accountable for their actions, but they're not. And that's a problem, a big problem. But we can't do anything about it, because who are we? Right? Just like that, SIU came out. They're cleared, of course. Not surprised.
On May 27, 2020, in the High Park neighborhood in Toronto, Regis Kurczynski-Paquette, a 29-year-old black Indigenous woman, ended up dead after an encounter with Toronto police. She was diagnosed with epilepsy, and the police were called by her mother to try to de-escalate an unsafe mental health situation. All of this is under several investigations, so I'm very careful with my words. One of those investigations, however, the one led by the Special Investigations Unit, the SIU, cleared all the police officers that were at the scene. This decision sparked a new set of anti-racism protests across Canada, which is just continuing a series of protests that started after the murder of George Floyd in the United States. Whatever the truth is, and probably only the people who were in that apartment know what it is, this case goes to the list of cases in which people with mental issues ended up dead after coming across police officers in Canada. People like Ijaz Chaudhry, Ian Price, and Andrew Loco, among others. Organization in Toronto called Doctors for Defunding Police started a petition signed by more than 600 Canadian doctors and health professionals, warning that policing in this country is a public health crisis and calling for a change on how this society is reacting to mental health issues. We're talking with Dr. Suzanne Shush and medical student Samir Boulay from the University of Toronto.
I am a third-year medical student now, which is really weird to say, considering I grew up on the west side of Toronto. So, like, I'm born and raised in the city. Parents are refugees, came to the downtown government housing, moved out to the sub, like, to Etobicoke, which is where most people grow up in the area. And if you've ever heard of the northwest region of Toronto, there's, like, two big regions that are, like, very heavily policed, to be completely honest. It's the northwest region in Etobicoke and the east in Scarborough. And growing up in this community, right, the schools are not good. There's no after-school programs for, like, community purposes. Or honestly, like, there's not much, to be completely honest, if you want something to have better and have a better opportunity for a better life, to be completely honest. So with me and growing up in that situation, like, I saw all the same kids that grew up with me fall into gun violence, gang violence, into the crime or whatever you guys want to call it, because there are no opportunities in school or what was going on in our main system.
I have a incredibly strong mother and father. My mother herself actually was a constitutional lawyer. So she started studying constitutional law, essentially to make sure that we were in a position to always understand our rights, to always understand our place, to always understand that we have value in this country.
Everything that I did to get ahead was because of my mom and like keeping me away from the school system. Like the school systems that you don't understand in the public school systems for Black people, they're made to tear you down. Like if you understand the school system that I come from, 42% of all Black students are suspended at least once by the time they graduate. They perpetually criminalized and told that, hey, we're gonna put you into applied classes, and they try to put me in applied classes.
I once had a high school guidance counselor encourage me to apply for an Indigenous scholarship, and the way that he asked me to apply for it was he like brought me into his room and he was acting like it was like a secret that he had found out about, that I had this Indigenous mother, and like he didn't want to, like he wanted to secretly talk to me about this, and then he went on to tell me that I could apply for scholarships and I should not be ashamed because there are some Indigenous people who are so beautiful that you can't even tell that they're Indigenous. And I was like, oh, there is so much anti-Indigenous racism across the country. Even more, you know, when I was growing up, I felt it a lot more than I felt the anti-Black racism. And there was a protection in it sounds insane, but there's protection in just letting people not know.
When I was 15, 16, I got my, like, first started driving. I got an old Camry, like my old family car, the first car they had, just nothing special. Every time you drive down the road, the cop would be going the other direction. They'd look at you, pull you, turn around, pull you over, and then every time they talk to you, they say the same thing. Oh, we're just pulling over to check on you. Well, what's going on? What's happening? We just had a complaint in the area. There'd always be some type of reason they'd make, and I end up never getting a ticket. Nothing ever really happened. It was just so pervasive that they were watching you, and they want you to know it. And that's the type of community that we grew up in. And the fact that I make it out, that doesn't make it any better. One time I was in a car, so I'm Black. My cousins are obviously Black, and my cousins are in the car with me. We're by Humber Hospital, so the area beside my parents, my father's home. We pull up to the bank to just take out some money for my cousin. It's like 8 p.m., the quiet, normal neighborhood, nothing going on. Pull up, go to the bank. He walks in. Within 30 seconds, there's 10 police cars pulled over all around us, searching us, saying, hey, you know what? This is a robbery. We're here to stop you guys. We need to search everything we have on you. So what do they do? What do? We give up all our stuff. They search our stuff, as always. I've been searched more times than you can even believe. And it's just because in these situations, to get out of them, if you try to say, hey, I have my rights, you're not allowed to like search me, or you're not allowed to do this, it's over for you. Like I was taught at an early age by my mom as a sense of survival, just literally just give them whatever they want, make sure they leave you alone, because they will take more from you. And that's the only reason I'm here, because I knew how to talk to cops.
This is CKMS, and I'm your host, Ivan Angelovsky. You're listening to our conversation with Dr. Suzanne Shush and medical student Samir Boulay, who started the petition signed by more than 600 Canadian doctors and health professionals to change how this society is reacting to mental health issues.
Even when I was a medical student, we would see incidences of horrific anti-Black and anti-Indigenous racism. For example, a young Indigenous woman who came in beaten so badly, and the police brought her in and had been the ones that had beaten her. And the report was that they suspected drunk driving. And then the questions of how on earth does somebody with suspected drunk driving end up with these severe facial injuries, body injuries? That's a young girl who's quite small. So we've seeing the direct physical impact of issues of police brutality that were more common to see among Indigenous and Black patients coming through our eMERGE.
Poverty in Toronto is declared under $34,000. The people in my community, so half the people making under $34,000, did you know they have a post-secondary graduate education degree? So half the people who are living in poverty have a degree from where I come from. So it's not like education is the only thing, even though education they've been trying to push us out. there's just a lot of things that have been going on that have not been talked about, that because now people like me are starting to get into academia and somehow making it out, you're starting to see the stories that are coming out. Because for every one of us that gets out, there are thousands that didn't even get the chance. I love my white friends. Like, I love them to death. But like, when I talk, like, I can give you an example. So first class of medical school, we have this portfolio session. So it's a session with like six other kids. None of us know each other, all different backgrounds. And we sit down with a scholar. And we were talking about like situations that like where we grow up and what we want to change, stuff like that, just basic stuff. And I started talking about police violence and what's going on in our community, in the black community. And this white kid beside me, who's now my friend, like we are 100% friends now. But at the time, he brought up to counter me, he's like, yeah, but don't you think it's more of like just a poverty issue? Or like, you know, cops aren't really that bad. They just look at what they want to do. And like, and it's like, no, there's no description of what's actually going on in these communities, because there's no reason to focus on it in the media or in like popular entertainment. Like, it's not good to focus on this type of stuff. So he, being a medical student who has like the most privilege, most understanding, he's very well a studious person, doesn't even know what's happening in his own community that he has to serve as a doctor. So how do we expect normal people to even know what's going on? Like, when doctors don't even know what's going on.
So there's something called healthcare stereotype threat, and healthcare stereotype threat really is just a way of describing the implicit biases that are baked into our system. So first and foremost, like I mentioned earlier, the significant underrepresentation of Indigenous and Black people in medicine to start with, or in nursing, in social work, in psychology, in healthcare services. So we see this historical exclusion of Indigenous and Black people from access to resources that would allow them to get into medicine.
The history of medicine is so bad that there's no reason for any Black person to ever trust what a doctor tells them. It, like, if you really look at what we're doing, like even today, what was it? The John Rivers story, if you heard about him, the guy who, he literally, a 21-year-old Black man was telling them like, hey, I have pain, I need surgery. And they deny him four times and he's like about to die. And like, we have these stories happening over and over again. So with the Black community, I was able to connect the dots there, get involved, and just make it happen.
We are not taught to think critically about anti-oppression, anti-Black racism, and anti-Indigenous racism. We're actually taught almost quite little about the history of Canada and the role that Canada has played in developing developing these inequities that we see today. So, for example, we talk about communities as being the vulnerable communities, but really what they are is they're structurally excluded by design. So this is not a vulnerability of a community. In fact, Indigenous and Black communities tend to be extraordinarily resilient. But a lot of the healthcare terminology we use to describe people from these communities tends to be very patronizing. We also see just catastrophic and unexplainable gaps in healthcare that have been highlighted repeatedly. So from the beginning, from predating the TRC, there was the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People, the TRC, there was the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Report, there's the UN report on African Canadians, all of which are pointing out significant gaps in healthcare. So Indigenous and Black communities carrying a significantly higher burden of chronic disease, a significantly shorter life expectancy. There tends to be more of what makes you unwell and less of what makes you well available to these communities. We see the way that our mentors and our teachers and the people who are evaluating us are not reflective of the community that we serve, and they themselves have not necessarily been appropriately trained or taught in anti-oppression and anti-bias and implicit bias training. So when we talk about that healthcare stereotype threat, that's literally the healthcare stereotype threat, for example, that killed Brian Sinclair so famously, where the Winnipeg coroner literally said on his death certificate that the cause of death was racism. And this was, I'm sure as all of your listeners will know the story of a man who was brought to the hospital, sent to the hospital by his own family doctor for concerns of sepsis, which is where you get an infection that goes into your blood and it makes you very, very sick very, very quickly. And unfortunately, he did deteriorate. He was in Indigenous man who was wheelchair bound, and he sat in the emerge for 34 hours until he was found with full rigor mortis. And that was the result of healthcare professionals repeatedly thinking that he was just drunk and homeless because he smelled and he was slurring his words and he was non-responsive. And all of those reasons were because he was dying. He was very sick and they could have, and it was an entirely preventable death. So we look at those situations where we're having these societal views that we carry with us as doctors and nurses and healthcare providers that that are very founded in bias, very founded in prejudice, and can really catastrophically impact the health and well-being of a patient.
To understand how complicit the healthcare system is in the systematic destruction of the Black communities that they were made to. Here's a perfect example. Here, like just a straight up example, the University of Toronto, like the school I go to. In 2001, there's a study that they signed with the government and all the other medical schools signed, where they acknowledge that there are four things that it takes to have a healthy population and a good medical school that works to help this population. They said that one of the main things was having a population that represents the people that actually live there. This is in 2001. Like they clearly understood from a long time ago that if you don't have doctors or practitioners that understand the health and the problems of those populations, it's not going to work. You can't help them. Like even if you want to say as many doctors and give them initiatives to go there, they won't do it. Incentives don't help. You need people from those communities to help those communities. And they knew that. In 2016, there was only one Black medical student admitted in a class of 270. And the University of Toronto is the only place that makes doctors for Toronto. Like, that's their definition by, like, the federal government gives the money to do that. And if they're not doing that, then if they can't even make the doctors that we need for these communities, in 2016, they only had one Black person in Toronto. What do you think is happening higher up in these hospital systems? Pearson just came out in 2017 with a textbook literally saying, like a nursing textbook saying, that Black people have higher tolerances of pain and can take more pain, and Arabs and Muslims have this type of idea here. It's like, when you really look into medicine, the people who are at the top of medicine haven't changed. It's still the same white supremacist colonial look at how people are. And the idea that we test it on bodies, like, if you look at how we got most of the advancements we have today, a lot of them, like the Henrietta Lacks cells to find polio and cancer, these are from Black people that were never compensated at all from like what happened. They had no idea what was happening. They were used, tested on, made billions of dollars in profit on, and then discarded.
I'm Ivan Angelovsky, and this is CKMS, and you're listening to our conversation with Dr. Suzanne Schusch and medical student Samir Boulet, people behind the Doctors for Defunding Police initiative.
We have history and studies on policing in Toronto, and the SIU was built in 1990. Like, look into it, like what's happened since 1990. Like, we could look at how their cases have gone, and it just seems that people weren't looking into the exact information they wanted. And there was a question I even remember, like, I think Gord Perks, he asked for the last 10 years of police budget spending, like how much has it gone up, and like, versus other social spending. And like, they couldn't even answer that question. They said, like, oh, we only have up to 2013 and it's gone up 19.4% versus social spending, which went up to, I think, 13%. So it's like police budget has been going up greater than everything else. But then even when you ask for more extrapolation to see where it goes back to get better data, they don't have it.
The discussion for defunding the police has been something that's been ongoing in the Black and Indigenous community for centuries. So honestly, since the founding of the RCMP, which was actually founded in quite an act of violence against Indigenous people, one of their biggest mandates was to remove the non-compliant Indigenous people off their land. And we see that legacy of systemic violence that continues all the way up until the recent Wet'suwet'en crisis, where the RCMP were given lethal oversight to shoot to kill unarmed protesters or land protectors, which is the kind of colonial ongoing history of the RCMP and policing in our country. There is significant evidence that community-led solutions are far superior to policing interventions when it comes to keeping our communities safe. But unfortunately, we have limited resources. And when we're seeing a situation where we have limited resources and this astronomical police budget is being repeatedly reprioritized over every other option that they could have resourced, we know that it's not the police that keep you safe, but being in a place of privilege that keeps you safe. And I think that that's one of the things that's really critical to understand when we keep thinking about the fear and people being terrified of defunding the police for leading to some kind of a catastrophic crime wave. But in reality, the police are absolutely not what keeps us as a community safe. What keeps us as a community safe is having resources, having a political voice, having political influence, having financial security, housing security, having appropriate childcare, empowered in learning. All of these things can be created. And that actually, the creation of that privilege does not even have to come at the expense of the of our current system. This idea was actually a group of physicians. So it's a group of physicians and other doctors who wanted to voice our concern and make clear use our experience and our expertise to make clear to our city council and to our leaders really that enough is enough. We are funding and we are bankrolling a system that is not only inefficient, but it is proving to be deadly. We initially started with about 54, like a group of about 50, somewhere between 50 and 60 doctors. And within 2 days, it grew to more than 500. So you can see the momentum and the awareness in the community has really reached a much higher level where people want to be involved. They want to hear their voice. They want to know, they want to express that there's a wealth of knowledge regarding how we can build safety and it needs to be listened to.
So we have three basic demands, and like they're in line with the community and what the Black community has been asking for decades, because this type of study and the type of police brutality stuff isn't new to us. We've been studying it for decades. And so the three demands that we were always asking was the first, the end of qualified immunity. The idea that police can interact with civilians with complete carte blanche to whatever they do and have no repercussions is a huge problem as to what's going on today. Like if you hear the story of like DeAndre Campbell, the Black man who called the 911 on himself, the officer who killed him to this day still hasn't been given his notes to be investigated. He's refusing to be investigated. Like that type of stuff shouldn't be acceptable to any type of society. Like if you commit a murder, no matter who you are, you should have to be investigated. And that's what we're trying to say. Like qualified immunity has to stop first. The second thing is we want transparency of the budget. It seems like nobody knows what's actually going in, and we want a line by line cost benefit analysis as to like why the money is going here versus other areas. Like when it comes to medicine, every single dollar we spend here is scrutinized like by a fine tooth comb. And we're just asking for police to have the same thing. Like, we want you guys to go through your budget and see, okay, is this good or is this not good? We want to fully understand. And the last and the most important thing is the defunding of the police. Because at this, with the redirection towards community-based organizations and services like mental health, drug addiction programs, and things that could actually be proactive in removing these situations than being reactive like the police. So what we're trying to say is we want community involvement and community health to be the main thing that comes out of these interactions. So whatever will create those environments is what we want.
Using the status quo to threaten Black and Indigenous communities is a form of violence. When they're saying, oh, this system is bad now, if you try and change it, we'll make it worse for you. We'll increase your number of unemployment. We will increase the number of people who are out of a job. We will make life harder and worse for your community and concentrate the power in a handful of police that look less and less like you every single day. That argument being made was a shocking argument of truly ignorance. For example, when they were talking about how they cannot even fire an officer if he's found guilty of misconduct. This is unbelievable. How could they have put our lives, the lives of our families, the lives of our children at risk like this? If we are unable to hold these police accountable in any way, shape, or form, then the whole system is rotten to the core and absolutely has to be changed.
Clearly at this point, policing as a way to stop crime and stop violence isn't working. These people in these communities are still committing these same violent crimes, these same acts are still happening. We want an approach that is more holistic and understanding of the underlying issues. And that is all we're asking for. There's an analogy I heard that I thought was a very good example. When someone has a heart attack, you don't call the police. When someone has a health crisis, you don't call the police. We've been saying mental health is health. Like, we've been saying that. Drug addiction is a health issue, not a criminalization issue. So, like, why are we still calling the police for these issues if we are saying that they are not criminal issues. It's like we have a disconnect somewhere where we are saying one thing but doing it next. And as people who are working in the field, we see the police come and interact with these, especially when it comes to mental health. Like, I want to go to psychiatry, so I really work there. And we see when the police come and how they escalate these situations that were so, like, fragile. Like, these situations needed, like, a delicate touch. And because we didn't have the power and we had to call the cops, because you have to put them on Form 1 legally when you need to keep someone against their will, and the cops have to show up. If things escalate and they get worse, then what was the point of that? And that is our only point. We're spending so much money to have police officers come. Because remember, when we call police officers, it's still taxpayer dollars. And we want to make sure that when they're called, it is the most efficient use of our money. And that is literally it. And if it's not helping our health, then it must be hurting it, because we're still spending money on it.
You've been listening to interviews with Dr. Suzanne Shush and medical student Samir Boulet from the University of Toronto, people who started the petition signed by more than 600 Canadian doctors and health professionals to change how this society is reacting to mental health issues and trying to defund the police. This was CKMS Newsroom at 102.7 FM. Check out the archived versions of this program and other episodes on radiowaterloo.ca/news, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Waterloo. You can also email news@radiowaterloo.ca to get in touch with comments or ideas about stories to cover. The music was Black Room by Moby, thanks to mobygratis.com. My name is Ivan Angelovsky, and I was your host for this program.